The next day, as the sun hung red above the sea mist in the west, we followed the narrow path into the grove of Aelbunia and came to the sacred enclosure. It looked as derelict and lonesome as the woodcutter's hut. Its oracle spoke chiefly to those of my father's lineage, and there were few of us left now, some old cousins still living in Laurentum, and myself, and Silvius. No one had done sacrifice there for a year or more. The remnants of fleece on the ground were mere black shreds. We cut a turf for the altar, and Silvius poured out the flask of wine as offering, while I prayed to the ancestors and powers of the place. It was already too dark to go to the pools. We had brought our cloaks. My son laid his out just where my father had slept when we were here. I took my old place near the altar where I had sat and talked to the poet. We sat in the darkness for a long time, silent. The stars burned white through the black leaves of the trees. When I looked over, I saw Silvius had lain down, curled up in his cloak. He looked like a lamb asleep in the starlight. I sat awake. The creatures of the night made separate sounds, rustlings and scratchings, near and far on the forest floor. An owl called once, from the right, far away up on the hillside, a long quavering ee, ee, ee. I felt no urgent presence of the spirits of the place. It was all silent, all sacred. After a long time, when the constellations had changed, I spoke to the poet, not aloud, but in my mind. Dear poet, all you told me came to be. You guided me truly up to Aeneas' death. Since then I've let others lead me, but I go astray. I can't trust Ascanius. He doesn't know his own enmity to Silvius. I wish you were here to guide me now. I wish you could sing to me. No voice spoke. The hush had grown very deep. I sighed at last and lay down, overcome by sleep. Sleep made the ground seem soft and the cloak warm to me. Words and images drifted through my mind. The words were, "Speak me." Then they turned and seemed to reverse themselves as they drifted away. "I say your being." I saw Aeneas' shield very clearly for an instant, the turn of the she-wolf's head to her bright flank. I felt myself lying on a vault like a turtle shell of earth and stone that arched over a great dark hollow. Below me lay a vast landscape of shadows, forests of shadowy trees. Out beyond those trees, I saw my son standing in dim sunlight on the bank of a river wider than Tiber, so broad and misty I could not clearly see the other shore. Silvius was a man of 19 or 20. He was leaning on Aeneas' great spear, and he looked as Aeneas must have looked when he was young. There were multitudes of people all up and down the endless grassy bank. The grass was shadowy gray, not green. A voice near me, by my ear, an old man's voice, was speaking softly. "Your last child, whom your wife Lavinia will bring up in the woods, a king, a father of kings." Then I had so strong a sense of my husband's presence, his physical body and being with me, in me, as if I were he, that I woke and found myself sitting up, bewildered in the dark, bereft. No one was there, only Silvius asleep across the clearing. The stars were fading as the sky paled. Silvius had slept without dreaming. It was I who had the dream and heard the voice, but it was not my grandfather who spoke. At dawn, we rose and went to the spring. While Silvius explored about the cave, I sat on the rock outcrop and watched the sunlight strike across the pale water through the low mists that always hung above it. The stink of sulfur was less strong in the morning air. We bathed in shallow pools a little way downstream from the dead, muddy ground at the cave mouth. The water was warm and felt soft on the skin. It would be a good place to bring arthritis or an old aching wound. We went back to the enclosure, and having nothing else to offer in thanks, we heaped the altar with sweet herbs, boughs of bay laurel, and what few flowers we found in clearings in the woods. When we had done that and said our thanks, before we left the sacred place, I told Silvius my dream. I saw you, a grown man, yet it was as if you were not yet born, as if you stood waiting to live. And beside me an old man was speaking. He was not speaking to me. He spoke of you to your father, Aeneas. He said, "That is your last son, a king and father of kings, whom your wife Lavinia will bring up in the woods." And then the dream ended. We pondered it as we went back to the woodcutter's hut. "It means we're to stay here, in the forest, doesn't it, Mother?" Silvia said at last. It was what I had been thinking, yet my first impulse was to deny it, to say no. It couldn't be that clear and simple. I said nothing till we came into the clearing, and then, "It seems to mean that. But how? We can't lurk here like outcasts or beggars, living off what Maruna can send us. I can hunt and snare, Mother." "You certainly can, and you'd better do it too if you want me tonight. But in the long run, people will see us. Everybody here knows us, after all. We can't just vanish into the forest. If we went farther, we could. Up in the hills. For how long, child? Summer, yes. Autumn, maybe. Winter, no. Life's hard for those who live apart from others, even if they have a sound roof and a full granary. You and I are too soft for it. But I will not take orders from Ascanius. If I obey him in this, if I give him you, even if I go with you, I will have given your kingship away. He must accept our sovereignty in Lavinium. Where can we go?" "Well, what if people do recognize us and find out where we are? Would anybody make us go to Alba? If we said we were supposed to live in the woods, if we told them the oracle said so? I don't know." "Well, let's find out," Silvia said. "It is pleasant when your child says what you want to say." "His pigs told him to go to Alba," I said. "How can he argue with his grandfather, who tells us to stay here?" I began to remember how, when Faunus told my father in Albania that I must be married to a foreigner, Latinus had announced it right away to all and sundry. The more people heard it, the more powerful it was. Everyone, not just the king, had heard the oracle. "I think I should go to Lavinium today," I told Silvius. "You stay here. Get us a rabbit or quail if you can. If anybody but me comes here, disappear. I'll be back before evening." So I walked back along the foothills and across the fields to my city, thinking hard all the way, and entered the gate in mid-morning. I was relieved to find Ascanius had still not sent for Silvius, and I was surprised and touched by the welcome people gave me, crowding round me with greetings and caresses and anxious inquiries. I was the center of a whole throng by the time I had climbed the street to the Regia. "Here's my chance," I thought. So I turned round there before the house doors, while people of the household came crowding out behind me to make me welcome, and called, "People of my city!" They quieted down to hear me, and I spoke out, hardly knowing what I was going to say from one word to the next. "Last night in the forest of Albania, in the place of the oracle of my forefathers, I lay down by the altar to sleep, and the voice of King Anchises, father of our King Aeneas, spoke to me in dream, prophesying that his grandson Silvius was to live with me in the woods of Latium. In obedience to this foretelling, I will neither send my son to Alba Longa nor keep him here in Lavinium, but he and I will live in the forest until the signs and portents bid us do otherwise. The voice in the dream called Silvius king and father of kings. May you rejoice in that knowledge as I do." They put up a great shout at that, which heartened me, and I ended. "But till Silvius comes to the age of rule, Ascanius rules alone. and my city will continue to be governed by Ascanius and by his father's friends. But where will you go off to in the wilderness, little queen? Some old fellow in the crowd called out, and I answered, Not far, friend. My heart is in Lavinium with you. That made them cheer again, and I entered my house amid a considerable tumult, my heart beating very hard. Achates was there to meet me. Riding the goodwill of my people, I forestalled what he might have said, saying to him, My friend, I know Ascanius ordered you to bring Silvius to Alba Longa. As your queen, I ask you to obey me, leaving Silvius with me, letting the prophecy be fulfilled. He accepted that with a slow bow of his head, saying only, You saw the Lord Anchises? Incredulous, yet wistful, urgent, wanting to believe me. No, but I heard a voice that spoke as if to Aeneas. I took it to be his father's voice. The fathers speak in Albania. Achates hesitated, and then asked, Did you see him? Him was Aeneas, of course, and Achates spoke with such love and longing that the tears came into my eyes. I could only shake my head, and after a while I said, He was there with me, Achates, for a moment. But as I said it, I knew that it was not true. Aeneas had not been there with me as a man in the flesh, nor had Anchises spoken. It was the poet who spoke. It was all the words of the poet, the words of the maker, the foreteller, the truth-teller. Nothing more, nothing less. But was I myself any more or less than that? And this was nothing I could say to any living soul, or ever did, till now. I had been right to count on Ascanius' respect for portents and oracles, which he had learned from his father, but exaggerated almost to superstition. He was rigid in all observances. He longed to be called pious, as Aeneas was. Piety, to him, meant a man's obedience to the will of higher powers, a safe righteousness. He would never have believed that Aeneas saw his victory over Turnus as his own defeat. He did not understand that in his father's piety lay his tragedy. I may misjudge him. He may have come to share some of Aeneas' anguish of conscience as he grew older, but I never knew Ascanius well. At any rate, when Achates and Serestus took word to him of my decision, he entertained them without berating them for obeying me rather than him, and sent back no clear message at all to me. I think he felt himself forestalled by the combination of forces I had brought against him, the sacred oracle of the Italians speaking with the hallowed voice of the Trojan grandfather. By silence, he gave consent. So began the period of our exile. No exile at all compared to that of the old Trojans, forever homesick for their fallen city. Our living in the woods, which turned out to be a pretty easy life. I sent for some carpenters to come brace up the woodcutter's hut and thatchers to replace the rat-infested, rain-rotted roof. They ended up rebuilding the whole thing, adding on a second room and building a proper hearth, while volunteers swarmed in the clearing, chopping brambles, and spading and putting in a kitchen garden with every herb and vegetable that grows in Latium, even a sapling walnut tree and a full-grown Sicilian caperberry bush. They wanted to put a fence around it all, but I forbade it.
Wolves, queen, old Gurnus said. Bears!
And I said, there are no bears in Albania, and if a wolf comes here, I will call him brother. They took that saying back to Lavinium, and some people called me Mother Wolf after that. The way from town to the woodcutter's hut soon became a beaten path, and I had to limit the number of volunteer workmen and visitors to a few and only on certain days, or we would have had no peace there at all. When, late in summer, all the workmen were done, and it was quiet again. It was very quiet. Silvius was off all day in the forest or at his lessons, for the old Trojans took his education in hand with vigor and put him through a merciless daily schedule of exercises, military drills, weapons training, music, recitation, and equitation. When I had cleaned my house and tended my garden, I had little to do, and being used to having a great household to run, I was bored and lonely at first. I felt myself useless, a fraud. The Regias I had managed with such hard work and endless care in Laurentum, in Lavinium, in Alba Longa, were all going on perfectly well without me. Maruna, with Sicana as her second in command, kept the house in Lavinium, and did the worship as I had trained her long ago to do. So I could not ask her to be with me in the forest. But after a time I began to like my solitude. I lost the wish for any visitor or voice to break the silence of the trees, threaded always with the singing of insects and birds and the sound of wind and leaves. I gardened and spun and wove on the big loom set up in the second room and was content with silence until my son came back at evening to eat with me and talk a little quietly before sleep. And so the years passed. There were some border incidents, but Ascanius seemed to have lost his unhappy knack of stirring up wars. His marriage had been celebrated with great ceremony. His Rutulian wife kept his house in royal fashion, and they were said to be a happy couple, but they had no child. After a few years, Ascanius called in wise women and soothsayers. The wise women said that Seleika was in perfect health, and there was no reason she should not conceive. The soothsayers all foretold that she would die barren. They gave no cause or cure, and their prophecies were cloaked in images and cloudy language, for if the fault was in Ascanius, they did not wish to say so. I heard this and other news as gossip from Olivia and other women who came to visit with me, and from my Latin and Trojan counselors who ruled Lavinium and the northwest of Latium in Ascanius and my name. Achates and Silvius, too, saw to it that these men came to consult with me on matters of importance, so that I knew well enough what was happening in the country and around it, though I kept my advice to a minimum and entertained no guests at all. If an important traveler, king or trader, came to Latium, he was entertained at Alba Longa. He was told that Queen Lavinia was living with her son in the forest, in obedience to an oracle, and so could not be seen. I had to turn away even Tarchon of Kyri, who came to Lavinium, and whom I longed to see. I let Silvius go to him once, but I had to refuse myself, or else my exile became a mere mockery. But I could trust Achates and Menestheus to entertain him as befitted a great Etruscan king and a true friend of my husband and my son. Tarchon did not go on to Alba Longa, which signified pretty clearly that if Ascanius wanted his friendship, he must earn it. Unfortunately, Ascanius chose to test it severely by provoking the Veian Etruscans at Ruma. Their colony was growing larger. Latins in Fidene and Tiber, and around Lake Regillus, were now patrolling the outlying borders of their farmlands, since there had been inevitable episodes of cattle rustling, sheep stealing, quarrels at terminus stones. Mars was ready, as ever, to dance on the boundary lines. Ascanius had every right to defend his subjects' property, as Latinus had done when Evander's Greeks first settled there. But Latinus had a low opinion of the Seven Hills as a city site, thinking the river bottom unhealthy and the hills unfit for plowing or grazing, so he did not begrudge the territory to Evander. Ascanius did begrudge it. He had got on with the Etruscans thus far only by ignoring them. He thought them arrogant, perfidious, incalculable. He said a treaty with Etruscans was worse than useless, for they would not keep it, though the only one he made with them was when they helped him fight the war on Anio, and they had kept it. Holding himself superior to all Italians as a Trojan, son of the divine Aeneas, sent by fate to rule in Italy, he resented finding himself actually inferior to the Etruscans in wealth, manpower, weaponry, and the arts of life. His prejudice made him see them as all of one kind. In fact, Kyri and Veii were old rivals. Tarchon did not like to watch the other city-state expanding south of the Tiber. He had come to Lavinium to feel us out about the settlement at Ruma, and would have joined with us to put pressure on Veii to keep the settlement small. Achates and Seristus understood this, and counseled Ascanius to court Tarchon. Ascanius brushed their advice aside. In March, soon after the Leapers danced, he decided to teach Veii a lesson, He sent a small army to a disputed boundary between Ruma and Lake Regillus and drove the Etruscans, mostly shepherds, back almost to the Seven Hills. As they got closer to the settlement, reinforcements met them, and they began to turn and fight. Men were killed on both sides. To Ascania's soldiers, their losses justified them in keeping the flocks that fell into their hands. But by the end of a second day, they had to fall back all the way to Lake Regillus, letting go the sheep they had taken. The Rumans rounded up their flocks and stayed on armed guard all across the uncertain border. As if scornful of his enemy, Ascanius had not gone with his army. He put it in charge of his boyhood friend, Attis. I had known Attis as a handsome, warm-hearted, rather childish man who was kind to Silvius when we lived at Alba and gave him riding lessons. Retreating with his army, Attis had taken off his helmet, hot with the bright spring sunlight. A stone an Etruscan shepherd threw struck his head and knocked him from his horse, and he never recovered consciousness. They brought his body and those of five other soldiers home to Alba Longa. Ascanius broke down. He threw himself on Attis' body, weeping, and could not stop his tears. When his wife tried to console him and lead him away, he turned on her with cruel, senseless insults, screaming that she had whored with half his army and was barren because she was a whore. He could not be torn away from Attis' corpse until his weeping exhausted him, sobs becoming convulsions, and then a kind of swoon, from which he could not be roused. All this was in the great courtyard of the Regia, witnessed by many. Word of it came to Lavinium within hours. Silvius told me when he came home in the evening from his lessons. Everyone was shocked, puzzled, alarmed by this inordinate show of grief. Attis had been Ascanius' boy lover, but that was long ago. If Attis was so dear to him, why had he sent him on this mission? After all, he had experienced captains who knew the ground better, like Rutilus of Gabii, who had grown up there. Among the talk and speculation Sicana and the others brought me next day was a persistent tale that some time ago Ascanius had been overheard quarreling with Attis, shouting that he was ashamed of him. Attis' friends wondered if he had been sent to lead an inadequate army into danger as punishment, or to get rid of him. And many were now saying that Attis and Ascanius had never ceased to be lovers, that even on the eve of Ascanius' wedding they had met, and ever since. Amid such sad and shameful gossip, Ascanius lay still stricken in his room, seeing no one. His wife Salaika was turned from his door. Humiliated past endurance, she went with a group of her women to her family home in Erdia. I was fated, it seems, to live among people who suffered beyond measure from grief, who were driven mad by it. Though I suffered grief, I was doomed to sanity. This was no doing of the poet's. I know that he gave me nothing but modest blushes, and no character at all. I know that he said I raved and tore my golden tresses at my mother's death. He simply was not paying attention. I was silent then, tearless, and only intent on making her poor, soiled body decent. And my hair has always been dark. In truth, he gave me nothing but a name, and I have filled it with myself. Yet without him, would I even have a name? I have never blamed him. Even a poet cannot get everything right. It is strange, though, that he gave me no voice. I never spoke to him till we met that night by the altar under the oaks. Where is my voice from, I wonder? The voice that cries on the wind in the heights of Albania. The voice that speaks with no tongue, a language not its own. Well, these are questions I cannot answer. I will tell you now of another question I cannot answer, and a thing not many people believe. You will not believe it either, I know, but it is the truth. I had nothing to do with the Penates of Troy leaving the altar of the king's house in Alba Longa and coming to Lavinium. I gave no women orders to spirit them away by night, or men either, or children. Because it was an act that might have been calculated for political effect, there will always be suspicion, even open assumption, that it was planned and executed by me, or by someone else who wished to weaken Ascanius' authority. I do not think it was. I think the gods knew when it was time to come home. Maruna came to me at Albania, early in the morning, out of breath, and bade me come with her at once to Lavinium, to the Regia. I had not entered the gates of my city or my house for 5 years, but I knew Maruna would not summon me without cause. She hurried with me across the April fields, through the city gate, through the doors of the house, to the hearth of Vesta at the back of the hearth room where the Penates of Latium had stood ever since my father's death. And I saw standing with them the figures of clay and ivory, the gods of the house of Anchises, that Aeneas had brought with him across the lands and seas from Troy. I gasped and stood in awe, my legs trembling. I was shocked, incredulous, frightened. Yet the fear did not go very deep. I could not be terrified, because I could only see it as right that our gods should be here, in our house. So the others perhaps saw me as less amazed than I might have been, and thought my surprise and my questions a pretense. And indeed, I did not ask many questions. I thought it impious to question mortals about a matter that had apparently been carried out by greater powers. Of course, some of my women were capable of spiriting the Penates out of Alba and into Lavinium. But as I thought about it, I could not imagine any of them actually doing it. All of them seemed utterly surprised, dismayed, even terrified when they saw the figures on the altar. And they were honest women. I would not let them be interrogated. If indeed I found that one had done it, what was I to do with her? Punish? Praise? Best leave the inexplicable unexplained. As for the men, I left them to Achates, Seristus, and Menestheus, who I knew were themselves incapable of plotting an act of sacrilege, however welcome its implications. They found no suspects and no hint of how or even when the strange event had occurred. The first to see the gods had been Maruna herself, coming for the morning worship. I stayed in my city that day, among my people. I sent for Silvius and ordered a triple sacrifice, a lamb, a calf, and a young pig. Silvius presided, with the old Trojan captains to assist him. With the lifeblood and roasted meat of the good animals, we thanked and blessed the Lares and Penates of Troy and Latium, and asked their blessing. Maruna read the entrails, as the Etruscans do, and foretold from them great and lasting glory for the house of Aeneas. And then I went back to the little house in the forest. But my son stayed in the Regia that night, guarding his ancestral gods, seeking their blessing. In Alba Longa there had, of course, been great dismay, horror, when the absence of the old Penates was discovered. A little Camillus, a helper, a boy of 9, who first raised the alarm, had been beaten nearly to death by horrified women who blamed the mischief on him. Queen Salaiga, who might have calmed them, no longer lived there. They carried the news to King Ascanius with fear and trembling. He came out of his rooms then, for the first time since Attis' death. He walked across the great court to the Vestal hearth and stood gazing at it. Only the Penates of the old village of Alba Longa stood there, few and humble as the gods of a poor man's house. Vesta herself, the body of sacred fire, burned up clear and bright as ever. Ascanius cast a little salted meal into the fire. He lifted up his hands to pray, but he could not speak. Tears began to run down his face. He turned and went back in silence, weeping, to his rooms. Ascanius made no effort to find a human agency for the Penates' return to Lavinium. To him, as to me, it was a pure sign of the will of the powers greater than us. We accepted it as such. But while it was a miraculous joy to me and a portent of divine favor to Aeneas' younger son, to the elder son it was an almost fatal blow. I do not know whether his marriage had been such an unhappy mockery as, now, everyone was saying. All the women's quarters were abuzz with talk about how unhappy Salaiga had been from the very beginning, how she suffered from her husband's distaste for her, how she hid her humiliation even from her closest companions, except, of course, the one telling the story. If all that was true, Ascanius had also worn a public mask and never let it slip all these years. I think it likelier that something little by little went wrong in the marriage. Ascanius' sexual discomfort with women, perhaps driving him gradually back to seek the tender simplicities of his first love. And Attis, poor loyal soul, was there to offer them. Poor souls, all of them. But fate was hardest on Ascanius. He lost his lover and a battle at one stroke, at the next his wife, and then his father's gods. His choice of a capital was, it seemed, wrong. Everything he had built up to support his image of himself as Aeneas' worthy successor slipped away from him, like mud crumbling softly from a riverbank into the water. He could not pull himself together for a long time, so long that his war captains, despairing of getting any orders from him, came down to Lavinium and asked the counsel of the old Trojans and the young king. For so Silvius was openly called now. He would be 17 in May. He had lived in the forest following the oracle. He had served his term of exile. The return of the ancestral powers to his house was a clear sign. The young king and the gods had come home on the same day. The people of Lavinium and all western Latium made him a heartfelt, joyful welcome, bringing tribute unasked and overflowing. Soon from Gabii, Praeneste, Tibur, Nomentum, people were arriving to see and greet him and offer him their white lambs, their fine colts, their service in arms. There was a sense all over the country of a darkness lifting, a better hope. No mortal hope is ever fully satisfied, I know, but this overflow of good feeling and confidence secured much of its own fulfillment. The Latins saw themselves as a people again. They held up their heads. Only a fool could have spoiled so promising a start. Not being a fool, Silvius was cautious and often almost incredulous of his good fortune, and relied very much on the counsel of people he had learned to trust. But being 17 years old, he seized every advantage, accepted every gift, rejoiced in his popularity, offered love for love, and rode the fair wind as long as it blew, like a happy young hawk. When the captains came from Alba Longa, he called a council, and he called me to it. I demurred privately to him. I was so unused to being among people, after 5 years in the forest, that the idea appalled me. "I don't belong there," I said. "You sat in your father's council, and my father's." "No, I sat at the back and listened sometimes." "But you are the queen, queen mother." "A queen is a queen," said my son regally. He did look a good deal like Aeneas, but there was something of Latinus and myself, something Italian, in the way he stood and the way he turned his head. He knew how to occupy space. He would be a handsome man at 25, but an absolutely beautiful one at 50. Such maternal thoughts distracted me. I was staring at him as a cow stares at her calf, with mindless, endless contentment. "You are the queen here, mother, and you can't do anything about it unless I get married. Then you can retire if you insist, but I don't plan to marry any time soon. If you aren't the queen, then you're my subject, and I command you to attend the council." "Don't be childish, Silvius," I said. But he had won the game, of course. I attended his council. I sat at the back and never spoke. There was no use shocking Ascanius' captains. They were worried enough as it was. They had information that Vi had been sending armed men to Ruma ever since our ill-fated border raid. It looked as if the Etruscans planned either forays into our territory or an all-out attack on Gabii or Colatia. The chiefs of Alba Longa had sent all the men they could raise into the area to guard it, but it was a long border and our soldiers were spread thin. They had strict orders not to attack, only to defend.
"But we don't know what they'll be facing," said Marcius, a young general.
They were all young. Ascanius had not liked to have older men about him.
"We could double the army easily," Menestheus said. "There's great spirit among the people here."
"We could get in touch with Tarchon of Kyri," said Silvius.
The Albans looked blank, frowned.
"An Etruscan?" said Marcius.
Tarkon was here not long ago, and it seemed he had in mind an alliance to contain Ruma.
Seristus spoke.
But we were not then at liberty to discuss it with him.
There was a silence. I know you remember that Tarkon of Kiri helped you, or your father's, put my father on the throne of Latium, Silvius said. He said it mildly, not chiding or reproaching. I saw Akadis look at him with a half-smile. He was hearing his king speak. We all were.
We sent messengers to Kiri, recruits and volunteers to strengthen the Alban forces encircling the Seven Hills. In April, Tarkon's army moved eastward from Kiri, cutting off the route from Bi to the Tiber. There were some skirmishes in Etruria, none in Latium. The colony at Ruma withdrew all forces from its borders. Its men ceased to threaten our farms and cities, turning back to plowing and harvesting. Silvius had won his first war without fighting it. At the end of that summer, he rode to the woodcutter's house on his handsome chestnut stallion and said to me, Mother, I think you should come back to your city. I had been thinking the same thing and merely nodded. It was a great pleasure to live again in the high house of Lavinium, to sweep Vesta's hearth and prepare the salted meal for my gods and Aeneas' gods, to look after a great storeroom and a busy household, to have children about underfoot and women to talk things over with, and the deep ring of men's voices out in the stable yard. In that life, which had been all my life till we went to the forest, the years slipped away. Silvius went up to Alba Longa often, meeting amicably with his brother, sharing the duties of rule, though now Ascanius took second place, deferring to the younger king. He came a few times to Lavinium for festivals or councils, a sad-eyed, heavy-set, stooped man who fussed over trifles. His wife lived on in Erdia, in her brother Camer's household. Silvius, who frequently crossed the Tiber, cultivating amity with Etruria, married the Kirin Lady Ramtha Matuni, a beautiful and noble woman. We held a great wedding in Lavinium. The children began to come, a girl, a boy, a girl. Then I was the grandmother queen in the noisy courtyard, where the laurel tree I had planted when I came there with Aeneas towered over the walls. When Ascanius had ruled 30 years in Alba Longa, he gave up his crown. Silvius, called Aeneas Silvius by his people, ruled Latium alone. He moved then to Alba, for it was in truth a better center of rule than Lavinium. He begged me to come with him and Ramtha and the children, but I was not going to leave my city again, or not in that direction. He did not try to move his Lares and Penates, for they, like me, had shown their will was to stay where Aeneas put them. So I lived on as the old queen in the old regia. Within the threshold my husband carried me across on our wedding day. Sicana died at last, and Tida, but Maruna was with me always. Now and then we walked or rode in a donkey cart to sleepy Laurentum of our girlhood and spent an afternoon there by the fountain under the old laurel. Once we went on to the mouth of the Father River and filled our cart with the gray, dirty, sacred salt. Often we walked down from Lavinium to the Numicus and watched the water run, and coming home, stayed a while by the great stone tomb where Aeneas lay in state near his daughter who might have been, a shadow in shadows. Now and then we walked to Albania, and Maruna slept in the woodcutter's cottage while I went on alone into the forest, bearing fire for the altar and an offering of fruit or grain and wine, and the fleece of a dark-colored ewe on which I lay down in the sacred place to sleep. I heard no voices in the darkness among the trees. I saw no visions. I slept. Maruna fell ill. Her heart failed. She grew weak and could not rise to sweep the hearth. One morning I heard the women wailing. Silvius came for Maruna's 9th-day ceremony. No one wondered that a king should come to the funeral of a slave. He asked me again to come to Alba, to be with him, but I shook my head. I will live here with Aeneas, I told him. There were tears in his eyes, but he did not press me. He was, as I had thought he would be, a splendid man at 50, straight and strong-bodied, dark-eyed, with graying hair. "You are older than he was," I thought, but I did not tell him my thought. He had to be off. There was trouble from the Volscians or the Sabines or the Equians. There would always be war on the borders, and often in the heartland. So long as there is a kingdom, there will be another Turnus calling to be killed. For a time after Maruna's death, I did not go to Albania. I could not bear to go with anyone but her, and having grown somewhat lame, was timid about walking across the fields and up into the woods alone. At last, weary of my cowardice, I sent for Maruna's niece, Ursina, whom I had given a farmstead on the Prati. She walked with me to the woodcutter's house, then back to her farm to see her animals, and returned for me in the morning. She was still a lioness. A walk of 4 or 5 miles was nothing to her. So I could go to my forest when the need came on me. Once, when I went there in the winter, sleeping out on the fleeces in the cold, though it hardly rained at all, I got up very stiff at dawn and found myself feverish. I stayed in the woodcutter's house that day, but the doctors in Lavinium insisted on bringing me back to town where they could torment me more easily. It may be that that happened more than once. As I speak now, I feel my voice fail, as Maruna's heart failed, growing weak, so that even at the base of her throat one could hardly find the pulse. Even in my throat, I can hardly feel the vibration of the voice. But I will not die. I cannot. I will never go down among the shadows under Albania to see Aeneas tall among the warriors, gleaming in bronze. I will not speak to Creusa of Troy, as I once thought I might, or Dido of Carthage, proud and silent, still bearing the great sword wound in her breast. They lived and died as women do, and as the poet sang them. But he did not sing me enough life to die. He only gave me immortality. I do not need to call on Ursina to come with me anymore, not for a long time. One must be changed to be immortal. I can go from Lavinium to Albania on my own wings. More and more I live there, hunting among the trees in twilight, in starlight. My eyes need little light to see their prey. To me the night there is luminous, a soft radiance. When the sun begins to rise and dazzle all the sky, I find the dark place in the hollow oak. That is my high house now. It does not matter that the regia in Lavinium is only clay bricks in earth. In my dark bedroom, I sleep the days away, near the pools of stinking, misty water that once were sacred. I wake as the sun goes down and listen. My hearing is good. I can hear a mouse breathe among the fallen oak leaves. Through the noise of the water in the cave, I can hear the roar and rumor of the vast city that covers all the seven hills and the banks of the Father River and the old Pagus lines for miles and miles. I can hear the endless sound of the engines of war on all the roads of the world. But I stay here. I fly among the trees on soft wings that make no sound. Sometimes I call out, but not in a human voice. My cry is soft and quavering. "Ee, ee," I cry. "Go on, go." Only sometimes my soul wakes as a woman again. And then when I listen, I can hear silence. And in the silence, his voice.